Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. As always, I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. So as many of you are aware, since I've talked about it on social media, we're going to be switching topics here on Tides of History in just a few months, starting in June. We're going to be leaving behind the later Middle Ages and the early modern period, and we're going to be heading to prehistory. Going to cover everything from the origins of humanity all the way up to about the Bronze Age collapse over the course of the coming year. So to help us get into that, I've got not one but two great guests for you here today. Together, they host the podcast The Insight, which covers a wide range of topics related to genetics and which I highly recommend to you. Spencer Wells is an author, the founder and CEO of Insightome, and the former director of National Geographic's Genographic Project. Razib Khan is director of scientific content at Insightome and a longtime commentator on genetics and many other issues at his blog, Gene Expression. Spencer and Razib, thank you so much for joining me today.
Great to be here.
Same.
So, as I mentioned, in a few short months, we'll be switching from the early modern period to prehistory. The biggest reason I'm making that switch is because in the past couple of decades, our understanding of prehistory has been turned upside down. That's mostly because of genetics. So how exactly has genetics contributed to our understanding of prehistory?
Wow, that's a big question. I guess I can kick it off, Razib. So yeah, the idea that you could use genetics to study human population relationships actually dates back to the early part of the 20th century. The first description of stable biochemical polymorphisms or genetic differences at the biochemical level between different humans was discovered by a scientist named Carl Landsteiner in 1901 when he described the A, B, and O blood groups. And those were first used at a population level to study how populations might be related by the Hirschfelds, a dynamic husband and wife duo who were involved in the war effort on the medical side in World War I and had to, of course, transfuse a lot of blood and started to notice that there were differences in the frequencies of the type A and type B blood groups. And they came up with a model for human migration patterns on the basis of that. That continued up through the 1950s, the study of blood groups and trying to draw correlations with human migration patterns. And it was really the application of modern computational and statistical methods to those data patterns by a man who I actually did my postdoctoral research fellowship with at Stanford University, Luigi Luca Cavalli Sforza, in the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s. His work really kind of gave us the first proper insights into human migration patterns. Again, based on blood groups, these so-called classical polymorphisms. And then by the 1980s, DNA was introduced into the mix. We had methods for sequencing and genotyping DNA, studying the variation at the nucleotide level, and people started to draw trees of different individuals and populations. And you might have heard of the famous African Eve, discovered by Kahn, Stone, King, and Wilson in the late 1980s, early 1990s, a couple of seminal papers in the study of human population genetics. And it really kind of exploded as a field in the 90s and the noughts. And then genomics introduced to the mix in the last decade or so, the ability to study entire human genomes at the population level. And Razib, I think you can talk to that.
Yeah, and you know, Spencer has given a great introduction at the high level of the history of the field. I think the big thing that the listeners need to understand is genetics tests very specific hypotheses and questions in a very concrete way. And history and prehistory has a lot to do with demography and conjectures and hypotheses of demographic movements and relationships. And genetics is a tool that gives you a really, really direct window onto those relationships. So, you know, jumping ahead a little bit in what we're going to be talking about, when it comes to something like Neanderthals, the question is, are they descended from the same common ancestor as modern humans, or are they part of our own lineage? That's a question that's been asked by paleoanthropologists for decades. And with ancient DNA and genetics of modern populations as well, that question was tested, and we have a very clear answer to that question now.
Yeah, so, and it's only gotten more complicated as we've gotten more data, and we can dig into that.
Yeah, so on a basic level, what genetics allows us to do is study how different populations, both ancient and modern, relate to one another. And on the basis of those relationships, we can talk about how they've moved through the world, how they've evolved over time and place. And just to give us a really direct sense, instead of having to look at things like stone tools or the other kind of tiny little remnants that these people have left behind, we can study the people themselves.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, the difficulty comes in making the interpretations. The genetic patterns are what they are, but in order to basically assign cultures or individuals or empires to those genetic patterns, you've historically had to do a lot of hand waving. So the dating methods that people have used in genetics until very recently have not been that accurate. So the error bars are quite wide. And, you know, when we talk about things happening 10,000 years ago, they could, you know, be happening between 7,000 and 17,000 in some cases. So it's really only recently, with the application of ancient DNA to this ancient material, the ability to effectively travel back in time to take a DNA sample from individuals who were living at a specific point in history that can often be carbon dated or using some other method of dating the remains, to really literally get an insight into specific individuals, specific cultures, how they were moving around the world and interacting with other people. It's really been a huge revolution.
So you mentioned one way of getting genetic data right there. You mentioned ancient DNA. So how do we do that? Like, how do we get DNA from bones that are thousands or tens of thousands years old?
Yeah, I mean, this is a tool that's really only come out of the last 20 or 30 years of research. People have been attempting to get DNA out of ancient remains since the 1980s. A very well-known, famous, wonderful geneticist named Svante Paabo published a paper in Nature back in the early 1980s where he purported to get DNA out of an ancient Egyptian mummy. It's likely that that was a contaminant. And this is often the issue with the study of ancient DNA, is that many of the things that you're attempting to extract ancient DNA from have been handled by many paleoanthropologists and archaeologists over the years. And when people handle things, they leave some of their DNA behind. The ancient DNA is highly degraded because it's so old, so the modern DNA tends to swamp it out. So it's really only in the last 20 years or so that people have developed methodologies that are kind of foolproof for obtaining DNA from ancient remains. Part of that is extracting DNA from particular sites in the skeleton that yield high quantities of ancient DNA. The petrous bone, which is an inner ear bone that is basically that little bump behind your ear if you feel your skull there. And then modern methods of molecular biology that allow them to effectively zoom in on the ancient material itself at the expense of any modern contamination. And so these are methods that, again, have only been developed relatively recently. DNA, it turns out, is relatively stable, and geneticists have been able to get DNA out of materials that are hundreds of thousands of years old. Typically, though, we're talking about analyses of materials that, you know, are between a few thousand years old and tens of thousands of years old.
So how then can we take that? So let's say we get some ancient DNA. What do we then compare that to? Like, how do we make that piece of evidence? How do we make those patterns speak to something larger?
So we have, because of modern technology, the SNP arrays, the whole genome sequencing, we have a lot of data. It's cheap from modern humans, right? We have hundreds of thousands, actually millions of individuals who've been genotyped. So that is one set of data you can compare it on. Because of the technological revolution in ancient DNA, and a lot of what Spencer is talking about here are incremental and sequential improvements in technology, from polymerase chain reaction in the 80s and 90s, to new methods of looking at the samples, say the petrous bone, as well as computation, of being able to look at patterns of degradation and damage and basically pull out those little ancient fragments out of all the modern fragments of the bacteria and the contaminants. All of these have come together and allowed us to generate all this data. And so because of these technological improvements, there are now thousands and thousands of ancient individuals at various time points from various locations that you can compare a given individual against. And I do want to reiterate for your listeners, when you take the genome of a single individual, and a genome is basically looking across all of their genetic map, that is actually the end point of a sequence of individuals that have been mating over many, many generations. And so when you sample one individual, you are capturing with genomics the whole history of a population going back in time. And so when we got the first European, Mesolithic European hunter-gatherers from the early Holocene in Europe, that actually ended up giving us a really good sense of what Mesolithic hunter-gatherers were like, because now we have dozens of more of these individuals, and they all seem relatively similar to the initial sample. And it's partly because populations are homogenous, but it's partly because when you're sampling one individual, you're sampling back in time to thousands and thousands of individuals.
Yeah, and an easy way to think about that is just to think about your own pedigree. So, you know, your DNA is the result of your parents and their parents and their parents and so on. And so you can see that very rapidly you add up individuals as you go back in time until, as Razib said, you're effectively sampling an entire population from one genome.
That's the thing that's so striking to me. It's the thing that I found so interesting in following this field over the past 10 years or so, mostly as a hobby, but now increasingly professionally, is just the sheer amount of data that's out there, the amount of data that one individual sample, one individual's ancient DNA can tell us, not just about that person. I mean, though it can increasingly tell us a lot about that person, but also about every single person leading up to them. That's just like a mind-boggling, mind-blowing thing to me. And I think we're only just now kind of starting to see what the actual implications of that are.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, in terms of applications of that, your listeners who might have heard of the Golden State Killer, very similar methodologies are applied for, you know, forensic purposes. So people who test in these genealogical databases are looking for a match of a short segment or a longer segment of DNA between their genome and someone else's genome that shows that they're related. You know, it's basically a similar idea that we're using to study ancient population history.
That's one of the things that's really striking about all this is how little we know about so much of the human past, right? That there are just huge stretches of time and place where we know very little about what was going on there. Artifacts such as they are may not survive at all. We may only have a few sites to define an entire culture over thousands and thousands of years. Suddenly, we have ancient DNA, and one of those little pieces of ancient DNA can shed light onto thousands and thousands and thousands of people. So how do we take that? How do we take that one little piece and make it speak to a map of the human past, to make it speak to population movements, to relationships between populations? How do we do that exactly?
Well, I mean, I would say that there's two general ways that I think about it. One way is it gives you an expectation of the dynamics that are defining the past. Okay. So, for example, the specific question of whether cultures are moving or expanding through cultural diffusion from person to person, or whether through some sort of demographic process where people move. Like, that's a very clear question that can be answered by genetics, and genetics has given us some general answers. I think the easiest way to say it is it's a bit of both, and it depends on the context. And so you can't say one or the other. I think until the recent past, we mostly wanted to say that, oh, well, people don't move. They just communicate with each other. It turns out that's almost certainly incorrect in the vast majority of cases. Like, even if there's not total population replacement, there's a substantial amount of movement of people with most cultural diffusions and expansions. The other thing is, in terms of integrating it, in a lot of contexts, there is a decent scaffold of non-genetic information. It's just that there's not specificity or clarity on the demographics sometimes of what is going on. So let me bring up concretely the example of the bell beakers in Western Europe. These people have been studied for decades. They're a very, very academically focused subject. But there were these insoluble disagreements about whether it was a population movement or not. Well, genetics can step into the fray and answer that very concrete question. It turns out it seems like it's both. It was a cultural expansion from Iberia into Central Europe, but once it got to Central Europe, it spread into Britain, seems to have been overwhelmingly dynamic. And so instead of a big general framework, here you're answering a very specific question in the details. And in a lot of situations, you do have details. Now, I do take your point that in some contexts, we don't actually like know very much at all about the archaeology because funding and like interests, like a lot of areas have not been well studied. And so genetics in those contexts can just introduce basically new information into a vacuum, and it's what we're actually going to build the future on, I think, in some areas.
Just to expand on the Bell Beaker example, I mean, that's a fantastic example because, as Razib said, these people, this culture, Bronze Age culture, 3rd millennium BC in Europe, have been extremely well studied at the archaeological level, but virtually nothing was known about them genetically. And a lot of assumptions were made, a lot of hand waving went on, but it appears that, for instance, when they entered Britain in the 3rd millennium BC, there was almost a 90% genetic replacement. So only 10% of the inhabitants who were living there before still had a genetic presence after the Bell Beaker people arrived. And this happened over the course of only a couple of centuries. And the way David Reich, who did a lot of this work, or people in his group have done a lot of the work, likes to describe it, is that the people who built Stonehenge at the end of the 4th millennium BC were not related to the people who were worshiping Stonehenge at the end of the 3rd millennium BC. And it's because of the influx of these Bell Beaker people.
So in this case, we have a very specific hypothesis that the genetic data allows us to test. In the Bell Beaker case, we can say, who were these people? Where did they come from? Where did they leave descendants? And so on. And that allows us to test that. In other places where we may not have that kind of background, the questions are going to be different. But either way, we can get an increasingly dynamic relationship between the kinds of questions that we ask on the basis of archaeology and what genetics allows us to answer. Is that about right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the power of ancient DNA. Again, it's that you can literally travel back in time. You can sample remains from a well-characterized culture that has been extremely accurately carbon dated. So you know exactly what you're talking about in terms of the people, in quotes, the society, the culture. And then you can determine who they were at the genetic level and their relationships to people who lived there in the same location before or after them, and also to other people living in other parts of the world, either at the same time, before or after. And so we can retrace these amazing ancient migrations.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
What has been most surprising to you as people who have been involved in this field for a really long time? What new pieces of information have been the most surprising to you, have kind of knocked your socks off?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'll take this first. There are so many things that have come out of the ancient DNA revolution that have really surprised me as somebody who's been a practicing human population geneticist for 3 decades now. I mean, just the notion that you could get DNA from Neanderthal remains is shocking enough. That was first done by a scientist named Matthias Krings, who was a graduate student with Svante Paabo back in 1997, a really seminal paper where they published a short segment of mitochondrial DNA. And the inference from that was that the Neanderthals, genetically speaking, were so divergent from all of modern humans that they were effectively another species. There had been no interbreeding. When modern humans emerged from Africa, America 60 to 70,000 years ago. They replaced the Neanderthals that were living in Europe and Central Asia at the time, drove them to extinction, and modern humans are the only ones left standing. So needless to say, it was a bit of a shock in 2010, 2011, when people started sequencing whole genomes from Neanderthal remains, which in and of itself is an amazing technical accomplishment. I mean, when I first read about this, I was like, no, that can't be possible. You can't get a whole genome from ancient remains, especially ancient remains that are 40, 50, 60,000 years old. But yes, it is in fact true. But the real shocker was, well, you know, the mitochondrial DNA was only telling part of the story. When you look at the whole genome and compare that to modern humans around the world, it turns out that the people living outside of Africa today are about 2% Neanderthal at the genetic level. So there was interbreeding between modern humans and these hominin cousins, these creatures that were so much like us in so many ways that had been living apart from the main human line for hundreds of thousands of years. Modern humans encountered them between 50, 60, 70,000 years ago outside of Africa, and they interbred with them. That's an amazing story.
And that kind of turns on our head a lot of what had been previously established understandings of the relationship between humans and our hominid cousins, right? Instead of it being a matter of total replacement, instead the human tree kind of weaves itself back and forth between these different species, that there are not just one interbreeding event, but multiple interbreeding events between populations as we go further and further back in time. The Neanderthals just being one example of that.
Yeah. And, you know, it turns out that in all likelihood, the entirety of hominin evolution, both inside and outside of Africa, is a series of these reticulations, as we call them, on the tree. So different lineages split apart and then they come back together and exchange genetic information. And so what we see today as Homo sapiens, in quotes, is really kind of amalgam of lots of other things that were walking around in various locations at various times over the last couple of million years. It's really a fascinating story, but so complex.
And Razib, what's been most surprising to you? Because you've been watching this field as it's developed essentially from its infancy.
Yeah, I know, you know, in 2006, I think the mammoth, was it the mammoth or the cave bear? It was cave bear genomics came out. And that's when I heard it, started hearing from people that Svante Paabo is going for humans. And I was like, what? We just got a draft of the human genome 6 years ago. And now we're trying to do this. That's just for your listeners, just get some perspective on how rapidly everything's happening. You know, I don't want to like overlap too much with Spencer, but I do have to say, if you had told me that 5% of the ancestry of the people of Papua New Guinea derived from a previously unknown hominin, whose only samples we have currently are from a cave on the border of Siberia and Mongolia, I would have said you were crazy. So that to me is the craziest result that I think kind of updated everyone's expectations of what we knew, because it suggested that our model had some huge holes. Because if a model cannot set the expectations for future results, that means it needs to be updated. And I think the Denisovans were one of the biggest shocks to me. Whereas now I'm not going to be as surprised if crazy results come out, because, you know, that happens. That's just part of how humans have been. Apparently we are a very,
promiscuous.
Okay. Spencer just said it. I don't know if you want to edit that out. Yes. I was trying to be a little bit more polite.
Yeah. So the Denisovans, I'm glad you brought them up, because it's, I think, one of the wildest stories we could have expected. Not something that anybody, if you were tossing hypotheses out there into the blue, not the one that you would have thought, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense. So on the basis of a tiny, tiny, tiny little finger bone from a cave in Siberia, we discovered that there was an entire previously unknown species of human. And not only that they existed, but they interbred with the ancestors of large segments of modern populations. We had no idea that these people existed, much less that they had interbred with the ancestors of populations that exist today. That's insane. That's an insane thing to happen.
It's insane, but it's, you know, it's the rule now. As Razib said, you know, it's no longer surprising. You know, there are ghost populations in Africa, you know, hominin creatures that we would have encountered in West Africa in all likelihood, interbred with. They're gone now, but a little piece of their DNA lives on in modern West Africans. There are probably, almost certainly, other things out in Eurasia, perhaps Homo erectus that we encountered, probably interbred with, maybe via one of these other lineages like Denisovans or Neanderthals. The Denisovans are really fascinating because it looks like their effective population size, so the total number of individuals in effect, was larger than that of the Neanderthals. So in a sense, they were more important than the Neanderthals. The Neanderthals were a tiny little side branch off of this main Denisovan population that seems to have largely been centered on East and Southeast Asia. So it's really uncovering lots of fascinating new details that we have never suspected before because we just don't have access to skeletal material. We don't even really, at the moment, know exactly what a Denisovan looks like, except it probably looks a little bit like a Neanderthal.
Yeah, they were, you know, closer to Neanderthals than they are to our modern human lineage. They diverged, you know, on the order of, say, 500 to 700,000 years ago, depending on how you do the calibrations. And I do want to say about Denisovans, the story here is very complex because with Neanderthals, there is a good amount of evidence that modern humans derive most of their Neanderthal ancestry from, you know, one primary mixing event. There were several different mixing events, but they don't always leave descendants in modern populations. So there's one in Romania that listeners to the Insight will know about. But in any case, with Denisovans, there's a really, really high probability now from the data we have that there were multiple mixing events with different diverse Denisovan populations. So everybody in East Asia and South Asia and Southeast Asia seems to have a low proportion of Denisovan ancestry. The Papuans may have two different types of Denisovan ancestry, and the people in the Philippines might have another type of Denisovan ancestry. So we're scratching the surface here. We need some ancient DNA of Denisovans that is not just from Siberia, because that's actually a very diverged type of Denisovan compared to the one that's predominant in the Papuans. Like, looking at all the genomes, we have enough data now to look at how the segments are related to each other. And the Denisovans look to be a very, shall we say, like a plural, we should say Denisovans. With the Neanderthals, like, they are like one dominant Neanderthal lineage that seems to have flourished from the Altai all the way into Europe.
So as far as that's concerned, this should be a pretty good window onto the limitations of the kind of evidence that can survive, on the kinds of evidence that different environments allow to survive, shall we say. So Neanderthals persisted in a range that was largely cold and dry, and that allowed a large proportion of their remains to survive to the present day. So we have a much better sense on the basis of those remains where Neanderthals were. So Denisovans, if they were living mostly in Southeast Asia, that is not good territory for the preservation of human remains. Those are not good environmental conditions for the preservation of bone. It tends to rot away. Or even if it did survive, we don't know what they looked like. So how do we identify those remains?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, one thing I will say is that there was a paper published in the last couple of months. We actually did an episode of The Insight talking about this, where they were able to analyze bones from the wet tropics, in this case, Cameroon in West Africa, that were nearly 10,000 years old. Mm-hmm. So again, the technology is getting better and better at you know, analyzing ancient DNA, even from samples that are suboptimal. So they don't all have to have been frozen in the permafrost or captured in a Siberian or a French cave. You know, we're able to analyze things from the wet tropics now. So I think there's going to be a lot of exciting stuff coming out of Southeast Asia in particular, and can't wait to start to fill in some of those gaps. Now, part of the problem in Southeast Asia is that it's changed a lot geographically. During the last glacial maximum, sea levels were about 300 feet lower, and we had the creation of vast land masses, Sundaland, which actually had savannas and lots of river valleys, and it was a wonderful place to live. Much of that region is now underwater. All that remains above water is the islands of Java, Borneo, and Sumatra. And so, you know, we're not going to be able to get DNA out of samples that have been under the ocean for 10,000 years. But the stuff up in the highlands, yeah, I think there's a reasonable chance that we will be able to get genetic information from those samples.
And that's a good way of telling us how much the field has changed, because I remember how impossible it's, like, we've talked before about, like, just how recent it is that you were able to extract whole genomes from ancient remains. The idea that you would be able to get samples out of remains that had been found in an area where it's hot and wet, that would have seemed crazy 6, 7, 8 years ago.
Yeah, I think the Petrus bone changed a lot. That inner ear bone that Spencer was talking about, that's how science is. There's a lot of fortuitous discoveries. And that's really opened a lot of avenues and opportunities that just would have been impossible before.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
So we've mostly been talking here about the more distant human past. We've been talking about the Mesolithic. We've been talking about Neanderthals, Denisovans, going back way, way, way towards the origins of our species. How can we use genetic information to shed light on more recent periods of the human past? You mentioned the bell beakers. That's a really good example. But so we have a whole stretch of prehistory where there were comparatively quite a few people running around, but where we don't yet have written evidence to help us understand what was going on. How can genetic data speak to those circumstances?
In more recent time periods, I think genetic data can give you a map. And, you know, I love the analogy or the metaphor of a map because there's a genetic map, but it can give you a map and a scaffold of like demographic processes that were occurring. And those demographic processes can then serve as kind of a frame for your interpretation of, you know, any writing you might have, any economic historical inferences you can make from other remains, pottery, these sorts of things. So let me give you a concrete example. I am very interested in the ancient Near East. I think like a lot of your listeners probably as well. You know, the genetic data is very clear that in the Aegean and also in the central and western Mediterranean, there was a pulse of gene flow that seems to have issued out of, let's say, like Anatolia, you know, modern day Turkey, about 4,000 years ago, and gone from east to west, brought haplogroup, I believe, J2 and higher frequencies, in any case, on the Y chromosome. I don't see any good interpretation of who those people were, because there's also a signal of ancestry that comes off the Eurasian steppe. And the assumption is, which is, I think, a good assumption, that these are Indo-European languages that we see all across Europe, because a similar signal is found in India. So that we understand, okay, this is when the Greeks arrived, you know, the ancestors of the Latin, you know, Italic-speaking peoples, etc. But who are these people that came from the east in Anatolia, and what is the archaeological context?
The Etruscans, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, there could be something like that. But this is kind of something not, I think, straightforwardly predictable from the history and the prehistory of that region. And I think genetics is telling us something major happened. So, okay, we need to go look. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So in cases where we have more information to work with, like I mentioned this a little bit before, but we can get a dynamic relationship between the various sets of evidence we have available. It allows us to pose and answer different kinds of questions from all those different kinds of material. If we see a genetic signal that is pointing to some kind of migration, we can look at the archaeological evidence and say, can we find this? Is this a thing that exists here? What kind of data could we point to try and help us understand this process? And vice versa, topic that I've been interested in for a very long time, the movements of barbarians around the end of the Roman Empire. A lot of the time, people who didn't leave written evidence of themselves, who were not literate, or their writings just haven't survived. That's another way in which we can start to answer some of those questions. There have been recent studies of barbarian DNA, and we can understand those population dynamics. We can understand the dynamics of migration around the end of the Roman Empire. That, to me, is just incredibly exciting.
Yeah, listen, Patrick, it's really kind of a wonderful field to go into if you are at heart a dilettante. because, you know, obviously the genetic work we do is grounded in hard science. You know, DNA sequences are DNA sequences, and they're very sound technological methodologies we use to obtain the genetic information and sound statistical methods we use for analyzing it. But in terms of the interpretation, you have to correlate that with linguistic patterns, historical patterns, archaeological patterns. And, you know, that's really quite honestly, the fun part for me is, you know, thinking about, well, what questions could we possibly answer with genetics? Because the goal isn't simply to prove that genetics can tell us about things that we already knew about. The goal is to really discover new things.
Yeah, it's one of the things that's been really striking to me, because I've been watching as this field of multidisciplinary history, archaeology, and genetics has developed over the past decade or so. I mean, like, I started reading Razib's blog a decade ago, and I used to teach with your book, The Journey of Man, Spencer. I used to use that in a class I taught at USC. So it's been fascinating watching this from the very beginning, watching the resolution of the questions that we can ask grow more and more detailed, especially the closer we get to the present day, the more varying kinds of evidence we have that we can make speak to each other. It's been fascinating to watch that all come together. And I'm just really excited for where the fields can go. It's why I'm so excited to move the topic to prehistory, because I think it's not just a chance to know things. It's a chance to think about how we know things and how we can make these various types of evidence, these various kinds of questions that we can ask, speak to one another and give us a real understanding of the human past. It's an interesting exercise in thinking and analyzing evidence.
There has been a lot of work done on the Pleistocene in Europe, and it shows the turnover of various populations from, you know, the Gravetians to the Solutrians and just all of these cultures that are just kind of names in our heads and how they are related. Well, I mean, adding the reality that you can sample at those locations and see how these populations are actually related to each other and how they contributed to each other does add kind of, I mean, to me, it makes it much more vivid to know that, well, the Magdalenians did not contribute very much. And the Magdalenians are well known because they did a lot of the cave paintings, right? They did not contribute that much to the genetics, it looks like, of Mesolithic Europeans, but they did some, especially in Spain and southern France. Like, to know those sorts of things illustrates, okay, there's some continuity as well as disruption.
And also, I mean, we touched on this when you were a guest on our show, Patrick, the whole idea of the dynamics of these migrations and conquests. And we talked about, for instance, the Anglo-Saxon invasion/migration into southeastern England from continental Europe. Now, to geneticists, if you see a genetic signal that appears over the course of 200 or 300 years, that's virtually instantaneous on the timescales we're used to dealing with. But in a social context, a historical context, that's quite a long time, and it tells a very different story. So I think getting at that level of granularity using ancient DNA is really kind of part of the future of the field.
Yeah, I mean, if you were, there were a young historian asking me today who wanted to study the end of the Roman Empire, the very early Middle Ages, I would say you need to spend a lot less time studying paleography and a lot more time studying genetics, because the kinds of questions that you want to answer are going to be much more likely that you can answer them with a knowledge of genetics and how that kind of data works than by studying ancient handwriting. If you had to pick one of the two, like, you should know how to read 6th century manuscripts, but you should also be able to read the addenda to and appendices to a paper discussing genetic evidence for migrations into 6th century England. That is just going to be a necessary tool for historians of the period where we have written evidence. It's another kind of essential tool that we have, not just for studying prehistory. I mean, I think all of this is being shaken out first in the study of prehistory because it's so game-changing there, so potentially game-changing, but it has so much to say about even more recent periods too. I'm stoked to see where it goes, and nobody has been more involved in kind of popularizing that than you two guys from very different directions.
Yeah, I mean, so one thing I do have to say is thanks in large part to David Reich's laboratory, and there's been some controversy related to this. People can Google it. There is just so much data that it's almost like an industrial, it's literally an industrial scale data production enterprise. And they actually do want to get archaeologists and historians involved. Frankly, like, I've heard, like, they don't want to collaborate with other geneticists because, like, they have enough, you know, resources and tools in-house to do that part. Okay, they want to reach out to archaeologists, to historians, because these people know things, they know models, they know theories, they have some priors that they can bring, because when you have just a bunch of genetic data, you could produce a lot of figures. But what do those figures mean? So, for example, Spencer is referencing the Anglo-Saxon migration, and I remember 20 years ago reading about this topic, and there were arguments between those who said, well, this is mostly elite mediated, et cetera, et cetera. And then other people who said, well, you know, there was like a mass migration. Now, the mass migrationists 20 years ago were very much in the minority from what I know. Now the genetic data is kind of converging on the result that there was a substantial migration, but it probably only contributed, depending on how you estimate it, 10 to 30% of the ancestry in England, which means that modern English people are mostly the descendants of Brittonic speaking Celts. But is 15 to 30% in a pre-modern context, is that trivial? I would say that is not trivial. That's a lot of people to imagine moving, a lot of, you know, reproductive differential perhaps in a couple of centuries. So even if it's a minority, I think it is substantial. And I think we need to add a little nuance and not just think of it as an either or.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what the genetic data in that particular context can allow us to do in ways that we never could have before. I remember reading an article called, like, Pots or People, Like, is it pottery that's moving, or is it people that are moving and then making the pottery there? And this was kind of the dichotomy of the question as it was presented. Like, this was 15 or 20 years ago when I was first looking at the Anglo-Saxon stuff. But the way that you posed that is a much more detailed, a much more dynamic, and frankly, a much more interesting way of approaching that problem. That, like, not just did people move, who were those people? How did they interact with the people who were already there? How was that understood? How did that play out over the course of centuries? Those are much, much, much more interesting questions, and they're questions that we can now get insight to thanks to genetics. And that's really exciting to me because it's stuff that those are questions that I've had for a really, really, really long time, like the entirety of my professional life. Now we can get some light shed on them. But I want to bring it back around to prehistory just before we go. You mentioned, we've talked a lot about migration. We've talked a lot about the movement of peoples. It seems like the kind of basic point that's emerging from the genetics is that people moved around a lot. They had relationships with other groups. They came together with other groups, then they diverged. They came together with other groups, then they diverged. Is it fair to say that the kind of bedrock of this new human story, such that we're getting it, is movement?
Yeah, we've always suspected that people have moved around. It's very clear that, you know, for instance, you look in the archaeological record in the Americas, there's no evidence for humans there prior to about 16,000 years ago. They must have come there from somewhere else. So migration is kind of part and parcel of being Homo sapiens. Humans migrated out of Africa within the last 100,000 years, probably primarily within the last 60 to 70,000 years. And so, you know, migration has always been central. What I think is surprising is the extent to which people have moved around and had such a huge genetic impact in the last, say, 5,000 years, you know, mm-hmm. since the dawn of the Bronze Age. There's been a huge shift in the genetic patterns in South Asia, Western Asia, Eurasia, probably in East Asia, but even in places that didn't go through the Bronze Age proper, we see some evidence for this, some sort of demographic shift that takes place in the last 5,000 years. So migration is part and parcel of being human.
All is change.
I can't think of a better note for us to end on than that. Guys, thank you so much for your time today. It's an absolute pleasure chatting with you. I would love to have you on again before I'm done with this topic of prehistory.
Absolutely.
Hey, thank you so much, guys. We'll chat again soon.
Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe and Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just 3 simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.